Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to the University of Southern Maine in Portland for a town hall discussion on China, presented by the World Affairs Council of Maine. Elliot Cutler delivers the main presentation. He's a lawyer who lived in China from 2006 to 2009 and a former candidate for governor here in Maine. He'll discuss the so-called rise of China and how the U.S. and China can avoid a historic trap. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to find this program again at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Kate McCarthy, Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of Maine.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Kate McCarthy, and I'm the Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of Maine. Thank you so much for being here tonight. We are one of 103 sites around the country that is participating in this event tonight. So it's nice to feel connected. I hope you all agree with that. Before I introduce our on-site speaker, I have a few thank yous to share. First, thank you to USM for this beautiful event space. For those of you in this space for the first time, this hall is named after Gerald Talbot. He is a very important advocate for civil rights and human rights in the state of Maine. Second, I'd like to thank both the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, with whom we've worked the last 3 years to run this Chinatown Hall, and also Camden Conference, a fantastic organization who explores the world from Mid-Coast Maine through both their annual conference in February of each year and through their related programming throughout the year. For those who don't yet know, this year's conference is titled, Is This China's Century? It will be running February 22nd through 24th. I also want to thank the students who are here tonight. I understand there are students from Cape Elizabeth High School and Gould Academy. Any other students here? No? Yes? Okay. Thank you for paying attention to what's going on outside of our state. Thank you for clearing your incredibly busy schedules to be with us tonight. To me, there is no greater measure of the success of our programming than to see students in our audiences. We have Mr. Elliot Cutler. He is a lawyer, a public servant, and a businessman. As a lawyer and strategist for governments, business corporations, and citizen groups, Elliot Cutler helped clients grapple with legal and public policy problems during a career in 3 law firms and 2 countries that spanned more than 35 years. From 06 to 09, Cutler lived in Beijing, where he opened the first office in mainland China for Akum Gump, was the partner in charge of the firm's Asia practice, and represented Chinese clients in making investments outside China. As a public servant, Cutler worked in DC from 1968 to 1973 for US Senator Edmund S. Muskie of Maine. He helped craft the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Superfund, the National Environmental Policy Act, among other environmental laws. From 77 to 80, Cutler served in the White House under President Jimmy Carter as Associate Director for Natural Resources, Energy, and Science in the Office of Management and Budget. Later in his career, Cutler was an independent candidate for governor in his home state of Maine and was founding CEO of the Maine Center for Graduate Professional Studies in the University of Maine system. Today, Cutler is a member of the board of directors and senior advisor to the chairman and to the CEO of Thornburg Investment Management, an asset management firm and family of mutual funds that Cutler helped to create in 1983, and that is now one of the 50 largest asset managers in the U.S. Cutler is leading the development of Thornburg's asset management business in Asia. He is also chairman of Maine Asia LLC, a company developing Asian markets for Maine food products. He is also a principal investor in Arc Solar, a company developing more efficient greenhouse technologies for sustainable year-round agriculture in Maine and other northern latitudes. He is a graduate of Deerfield Academy, Harvard College, and the Law School of Georgetown University. Thank you to Mr. Cutler for being with us tonight. We are thrilled to host you and grateful for your attention to the ever-important topic of U.S.-China relations. Please join me in welcoming Elliot Cutler.
Kate, thank you. I'm delighted to have chance to speak with so many of you tonight, and so many friends are here, and I'm grateful to you for coming. My first public statement on America's policies toward China came in a letter to the Bangor Daily News when I argued that John Foster Dulles was wrong and that we should support the admission of what I called Red China to the United Nations. That was in 1959. I was 13. Melanie and I did live in China from 2006 through 2009. I opened and managed the Beijing and the Taipei offices for my law firm, and Melanie was one of, if not the only, Western-trained psychiatrists practicing in Beijing. Subsequently, in conjunction with the largest food company in China, my partners and I, in a company called Maine Seafood Ventures, opened the China market for frozen Maine lobsters. And today, as Kate mentioned, I am developing an asset management business in China for one of the U.S.'s largest asset managers, and I spend about 12 weeks a year in Greater China. There certainly are limits to what I know about China, and as I texted my friend Stephen Harder, who is here tonight, there are many, many people here. And in Maine generally, who have spent more time in China than I have and know more about China than I do. But as all of you who are my friends know, that has never stopped me from saying what I think. I make no bones about being a Sinophile. Although I harbor grave objections to some of the Chinese government's policies, I admire the country's 5,000-year history, and acknowledge and respect the government's success during the last few decades for the Chinese people, raising more people, over 700 million, out of poverty faster than any other government at any other time. Finally, in full disclosure of my biases, I like the Chinese people. I've worked and practiced law all over the world, in Europe, across Asia, in Israel, in the Americas, and I would rather do business with the Chinese than just about anyone else outside the United States. They're more like us than most other people in the world. They are capitalists and entrepreneurs to the core. They share with us an ironic sense of humor. They're candid and straightforward for the most part and have strong family values. So for all those reasons and many, many more, I want to see the U.S. and China cooperate with each other, an objective that I think is a realistic one and actually within reach. But to get there will require on both sides greater sensitivity, increased understanding, better diplomacy, and some different behaviors, because this road to cooperation is one that Henry Kissinger, I think, correctly described as inherently complex. The road to cooperation is the subject of my talk with you tonight, and it's also a subtext of Professor Graham Allison's book, Destined for War, which I commend to all of you. Thucydides was the Athenian general who chronicled the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. And the Thucydides trap is the term coined by Professor Allison to describe what he called the natural, inevitable discombobulation, or later structural stress, that brought those two city-states to a decades-long war, and that occurs whenever a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power. Professor Allison wrote that as far ahead as the eye can see, the defining question about global order is whether China and the U.S. can escape the Thucydides trap. For the past several years, Allison and his colleagues at the Harvard Kennedy School have cataloged and studied 16 cases of structural stress that have occurred during the last 500 years. Allison asserts in the introduction to Destined for War that in 4 out of 16 cases where war was averted, and there were only 4, it was, and I quote, only because of huge, painful adjustments in attitudes and actions on the part of challenger and challenged alike. And in many of the other 12 cases, war was the outcome of what he termed, and again I am quoting, an all-too-rational struggle over predominance. Often there is a frighteningly thin and terribly pale gray line between thinking that is all-too-rational and thinking that is uninformed, unstrategic, and totally irrational. Too frequently, misled by what once appeared to be to someone to be rational thinking, we stumble into wars of all kinds, hot, cold, and trade. Henry Kissinger, who, of course, has been the preeminent practitioner of real politique, put the central question another way. Can the United States and China find a path down that inherently complex road to cooperation and develop what he described as joint concepts of world order? Now, in our relatively brief history as a dominant world power, the United States has developed and put into place concepts of order only A, unilaterally in circumstances where it could do so by fiat, B, jointly in circumstances where other nations in Europe or Asia were dependent on the United States for their security, or C, implicitly in circumstances such as during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, where order was achieved through the nuclear doctrine of mutually assured destruction. Today, the daunting question is whether we can develop and put into place a joint concept of world order through sensible strategic cooperation with a nation that is increasingly our equal and one that can make as strong a case for exceptionalism as we can. I want to first propose some perspectives on the major issues that currently divide the U.S. and China, trade, intellectual property, and regional security in the neighborhood of the South China Sea. Then I'll offer what I believe are three essential conditions, or three attitudes, for achieving a positive no-war outcome. And finally, I'll suggest what I think we should expect from a relationship that gets reset successfully and what failure or success in that endeavor can mean. Perspective is important for a couple of reasons. First, if we don't look at these issues through a lens that has been calibrated correctly, we're likely to draw the wrong inferences and reach the wrong conclusions. As Yukon Huang put it in his book, cracking the China conundrum. If the analysis is off, then likely so are the policies that are being advocated. And second, if we don't understand the view from the other side, it's unlikely that we'll be able to agree on anything. I'm fond of the aphorism, where you stand depends on where you sit. Often misattributed to Nelson Mandela, who certainly understood it, this is the Miles Law, named for a fellow named Rufus Miles, who was a budget official in the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations. And the basic lesson of the Miles Law, Mr. Miles later wrote, is that there is no such thing as pure objectivity in the arena of public policy making. For perspective on China as an economic powerhouse and on our trading relationships with them, let's start with this. China didn't come out of nowhere. The rise of China is really the return of China. Follow with me this history of world GDP since the birth of Christ.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Elliot Cutler is discussing the history of China's influence on world economics and why it's less of a rise and more of a resurgence.
China has always been an economic powerhouse since the earliest days of recorded history, through the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, through the Age of Discovery, the era of colonization, and up to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, for 2,000 years or more before the Opium Wars, China accounted for between 22 and 34% of the world GDP in every single year. But after the Second Opium War ended in 1860, China went into hibernation, beset for the next 120 years by epidemic opium abuse, internal struggles, foreign occupations, and revolution. During the time that China's share of world GDP was shrinking, the United States enjoyed the Industrial Revolution and the economies of both Europe and the United States caught fire. By 1950, the year after the revolution in China, and 90 years after the end of the Opium Wars, China's share of the world GDP had fallen from a high of about 34% to only 4.5%. China had a lot of catching up to do, and that process began in the 1980s and 1990s with Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin. Once the shackles on the economy were removed and capitalist entrepreneurial enterprise was encouraged, China more than caught up. And it's now the largest economy in the world on a purchasing power parity basis. What we are seeing is a reversion to the mean, to the normal condition. But what's extraordinary, of course, is how fast this happened. In 1980, China's GDP was only 7% of America's GDP. By 2015, even on an unadjusted basis, it had risen to 61%. Imports grew from 8% of America's to 73%, exports from 8% to 151%. And foreign reserves from 16% to 3,140%. What is also extraordinary and alarming to some is where this reversion to the mean is headed. About 10 years ago, the late Nobel Prize population economist Robert Fogel wrote a paper in which he projected the world's shares of GDP in the year 2040. Obviously, he wasn't trying to get it exactly right, but he was confident that he was directionally correct, and so far it appears that he was. Fogel predicted that in 2040, little more than two decades from now, China will produce 40% of the world GDP and the US 14%. So what is the lens through which we should view this phenomenon? Is it a zero-sum game, a competition between the US and China, where the win-lose result is measured simply by the conventional balance of trade surplus or deficit? Or is it more complicated than that? Well, the world is more complicated than that, much more complicated than the simplest measures of economic activity. Indeed, sometimes even the basic arithmetic is misleading or just plain wrong. For example, China has become the great assembler, a country full of still relatively low-wage workers, assembling components often imported from other countries into final products which are shipped to the United States and other consumer markets. You've all read about Foxconn, a Taiwanese company that employs hundreds of thousands of workers assembling iPhones and other products at its facilities in China. The final manufactured cost of an iPhone 7 is $237.45. And that is the amount credited with each imported iPhone 7 to the value of Chinese exports to the United States in our balance of trade calculations. Yet, in fact, the lion's share of that cost is tied up in components imported to China from other countries, including the United States. And the real value, the real Chinese value, the amount of each iPhone 7's cost that should be counted in the balance of trade as an import from China, which is the battery and the assembly, is $8.45, or 3.6% of the total value of the assembled device. And it gets more complicated. Deng Xiaoping unleashed this Chinese economic juggernaut when he told his people, "Let some people get rich first." Not at all clear that he meant such good fortune for foreigners as well as his own countrymen, but the great opening up was part of Deng's strategy. And today, General Motors sells more cars in China than it does in the United States. And more Chinese than Americans are using iPhones. Malls in China are jammed with stores of US companies, from Tesla to Major League Baseball to Kate Spade to Nike, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, and Pizza Hut are at the top of the list of the largest restaurant chains in China. No American company is more intertwined in the Chinese economy than Starbucks. I visited the largest Starbucks in the world, 30,000 square feet of coffee, and it was jammed with Chinese customers. And you know what? Starbucks is doubling down in China, preparing to open a new store every 15 hours for the next several years, growing to 6,000 total locations, and entering into a distribution agreement with the internet giant Alibaba. Nothing more clearly illustrates the extent to which U.S. companies are embedded in the Chinese economy than the fact that American companies with operations and subsidiaries in China sell hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods and services to Chinese customers. The absolute dollar amount of U.S. company sales in China is huge. $45 billion for Apple, $15 billion for Intel, $12 billion for Boeing, and billions more for scores of other American subsidiaries. Just as striking are the percentages of their worldwide sales that are made in China. 16% for BorgWarner, 22% for Corning, 65% for Qualcomm, and thanks to Macau, 75% for Wynn Resorts. Now, as Michael Symbolist pointed out in his J.P. Morgan newsletter, U.S. companies are doing almost the same amount of business in China through their subsidiaries as Chinese companies are doing in the U.S. via exports. In fact, when the sales in China by American company subsidiaries are taken into account, the balance of trade deficit literally vanishes. In terms of perspective, what does all this add up to? Well, first, it helps us see the reversion to the mean. China as a recovering giant in the world economy, returning quickly to the dominant position that it had occupied for centuries. And second, it illustrates that as far as trade and investment is concerned, these two massive economies are linked together as no two economies ever have been linked together before. Taking into account the central bank holdings of each other's debt, the outstanding stock of bilateral foreign direct investment, and bilateral annual trade, the economic linkages between the U.S. and China are many, many, many times deeper than any relationship in modern history. Moreover, as the iPhone example showed us, not only are the two economies mutually interdependent, they are together intertwined in a world economy that has become, all absent a cataclysmic depression and universal shrinkage, irreversibly global. From this perspective, it would seem that the right strategy for both countries would not be to throw the baby out with the bathwater, extracting themselves from a mutually beneficial relationship at enormous cost to both, but rather to engage in focused work, separately and together, to adopt and enforce joint concepts of order, and to limit the collateral damage, the environmental, employment, and social externalities that beset both countries and the rest of the world. A recent controversy over the possible industrial espionage facilitated by China's role as the great assembler has thrown a new spotlight on the intellectual property, or IP, issues that plague the U.S.-China relationship. And let me be clear, this is a serious set of issues with implications for each country's economy, for national security, and certainly for the prospects of establishing joint concepts of world order. But we also should understand that, as with so many other aspects of China's post-1980 phoenix-like ascent, there are striking parallels with our own history. In search for perspective, there are two points of context worth noting. First, there is no history of intellectual property protection in China prior to the late 20th century. And legions of Chinese inventions, including some of the most important in the history of mankind, paper, the printing press, gunpowder, the magnetic compass, made their way from China to the West and fueled the age of discovery and the Industrial Revolution. Second, America does not come as a complainant to this controversy with, as lawyers would say, clean hands. As Harvard Law School professor Fisher points out, it was, and I'm quoting him, the transformation of the United States from a net consumer of intellectual property to a net producer that had a predictable effect on the stance taken by the United States, so that by the late 20th century, the United States had become the world's most vigorous and effective champion of strengthened intellectual property rights after having been an IP miscreant for nearly two centuries. None of this excuses IP piracy then or now. But as we seek to establish and enforce the rules in this sector, once again, we should remember the Miles Law. Where you stand depends on where you sit. And its corollary, which is not necessarily where you sat before. As fragile as our trade and IP issues, but with far greater risks for everyone, regional security is increasingly a flashpoint in the U.S.-China relationship. In the face of largely appropriate outrage over China's militarization of reefs and islands in the South China Sea, and in my view, somewhat overwrought hand-wringing over the growth of China's defense spending and its construction and deployment of a blue water navy, one can't help but notice similarities between the histories of the South China and Caribbean seas. The United States never could have established the hegemony with which we have reigned over the world's oceans had it not been for the expansionist policies pursued by Presidents Monroe, Cleveland, and Theodore Roosevelt. In 1898, the Monroe Doctrine reached its full flowering with the Spanish-American War, ardently sought by Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, yellow journalist William Randolph Hearst, and rough rider Teddy Roosevelt. In a 109-day conflict with few casualties, the U.S. drove the Spanish from Cuba, and Spain ceded to the United States the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico. Later, as president, TR's gunboat diplomacy brought Panama and ultimately the Panama Canal into the U.S. fold. These were acts of aggression whose direct progeny we condemn today as violations of international law and threats to world peace. In the Caribbean and South China Seas, the United States before and China today have extended the spheres of influence to spheres of control. At least China has not yet repeated President Grover Cleveland's claim that the United States is, quote, sovereign on its continent and its fiats law upon the subjects to which it defines its interposition. Once more, where you stand depends on where you sit. And China sits in the middle of a historically fractious region where it is much more dependent on sea lanes and imports of food and resources for its population of 1.3 billion people than the U.S. is today or was in 1898. Kissinger put his finger on another critical difference. In contrast to the states bordering the Atlantic, he wrote, the states in Asia consider themselves in permanent potential conflict with their neighbors. It's not that they necessarily plan on war, he wrote. They simply do not exclude it. So from their point of view, and viewed from the perspective of our own history, the Chinese response to these circumstances in some, though not all respects, nor to its entire extent, could be seen as entirely appropriate. China has a third aircraft carrier under construction, probably on the way to a fleet of 5 or 6. We have 11. In 1995, China had 3 submarines. Their subsurface fleet now numbers 60 and will expand to 80. In sheer numbers of commissioned vessels, the Chinese Navy is bigger than the U.S. Navy by 317 to 283. In the South China Sea, at least, China is now a serious force. Admiral Philip Davidson, head of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, has told the Congress that China's capabilities make it capable of controlling the South China Sea in all scenarios short of war with the United States, and there is no guarantee that the United States would win such a conflict.
That's Elliot Cutler, Portland-based lawyer. He's considering how the U.S. and China can avoid a seemingly inevitable clash known as the Thucydides Trap. This is Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio.
So with all of these perspectives in mind, let's ponder what might be some of the essential conditions of thought and approach or attitudes for avoiding the Thucydides Trap. One of the first things that I learned upon moving to China in 2006 was how different the pantheon of values in China looks compared to ours in the United States. Whereas we hold most dear our freedoms, our individual rights and liberties, the top of the Chinese values pyramid is all about national unity, harmony, and stability. However much the Chinese Communist Party has reinforced this value structure, it is ancient and Confucian in its roots, stressing the importance of hierarchy and the collective good. Yukon Wang has observed that, and I'm quoting him here, geopolitical differences in values and inadequate analytical frameworks frequently get in the way of ideologically neutral engagement. Well, those differences are certainly evident in the implicit condemnations and now in Vice President Pence's explicit condemnations of each nation's values by the other. In his book on China, Kissinger wrote that if Air Crow, an official in the British Foreign Office who in 1907 analyzed the relationship between England and Germany, if Mr. Crow examined today's conflicts between the United States and China, he likely would find the tensions quite unremarkable. Quoting Kissinger, both Chinese and American governments have frequently assumed a seamless identity between their national policies and the general interests of mankind. Such rather cavalier assumptions about seamless identity do not make a solid foundation for joint concepts of world order. Both sides might be wise to pay attention to the first public speech by Wang Shishan when he became China's vice president. Every country, said Wang, who is China's second most powerful official, every country has its own realities, as well as a unique history and culture. All nations should pursue development plans that suit themselves. Each of our two countries has a set of compelling national interests that often change over the course of time. Germany was building a blue water navy in 1907 when Mr. Crow considered the likelihood of collision between British and German interests in his Foreign Office memorandum, and he argued that intentions are irrelevant. It was the substance of the famous Crow memorandum. Intentions are irrelevant. Only capabilities matter, he wrote. And if instruments of war exist, eventually they will be used to make war. Now, the Crow memorandum, the Crow argument, of course, is countered, at least so far, by the nuclear doctrine of mutually assured destruction and the experience of the Cold War, from which no hot war emerged. But it is certainly true that if capabilities exist, they're more likely to be employed, especially in the event of blunder and miscalculation, which is exactly what happened in 1914, 7 years after Crow's memorandum. In order to avoid blunder and miscalculation, each side should analyze capabilities cautiously and take into careful consideration what can be divined about intentions, and also what constraints are imposed by circumstance. The size and strength of naval and other military capabilities are important, but so too are needs and intentions. Princeton University professor Thomas Christensen has observed that China's external bravado is combined with internal anxiety. We should keep in mind that China has plenty of domestic challenges. 1.3 billion people and a per capita GDP that remains a fraction of ours. A rapidly aging, really rapidly aging population with a weak and fragmented social safety net. No immigration to rejuvenate the country, and serious environmental challenges ranging from vanishing water supplies to advancing desertification. However many similarities there are between the 20th and 21st century rise of China and the 19th and 20th century rise of the United States, and there are many, one thing is very different, and that is the pace of change. The pace of the changes in China, particularly in the coastal provinces, has impacted the economies, the politics, and the psychologies of the rest of the world nearly as much as it has impacted China. Whether measured in absolute terms, annual GDP growth exceeding 6% for 25 years in a row, or in relative terms, as we saw earlier, the rapid pace of China's economic development is unprecedented. Never before has a country emerged so rapidly as a powerful economic and geopolitical force. Every country in the world has felt some measure of dislocation as a consequence of this rapid pace of Chinese development. In the United States, the dislocation has been especially acute for workers in communities where jobs and the economic base have been diminished or eliminated in the transition from a manufacturing economy to a service and information-based economy. They have suffered dearly, while others in the economy have prospered as a result of lower prices for imported goods and higher profits for global businesses. One reaction to this dislocation, one born out of fear, anger, frustration, and jealousy, is nativism and the politics of scapegoating and demonology. A political leader who adopts this approach may reap short-term political gain by blaming new and allegedly unfair competition for dislocation in the local economy. But he or she will fail to engage with the rest of the world growing, with the rest of a world, growing inexorably more intertwined and interdependent. and ultimately he or she will fail to mitigate the local damage. One such reaction can lead to a counterreaction, and then another. And a change of course becomes progressively more difficult, eventually increasing the risk of conflict or war. A different reaction, one calculated to both lead to constructive engagement and to mitigate dislocation in the local economy, is to manage the change by diverting some of the benefit stream to retrain and re-educate workers and to redevelop floundering communities. The better the change is managed in those ways, the more room a political leader then has to engage the other side and to develop joint concepts of world order. So, with our head finally screwed on right, perhaps we could establish mutual trust and confidence. Assuming that we can, how should the U.S.-China relationship be reset in a manner that will avoid the Thucydides trap? Insofar as our trade relationship is concerned, once we have a clear picture of the real balances of trade and payments, then we can pay attention to what really should matter to both countries. Definite and realistic timetables for unfettered access to each other's markets, for the curtailment of subsidies to state-owned enterprises, for unconstrained flows of capital across borders, and for the internationalization of the Chinese currency. Since China is the fastest growing producer of intellectual property in the world and about to become the biggest, we should expect to see a gradually increasing interest in enforcing laws and treaty commitments and sustaining the international regime of IP protection. It can't come soon enough, as resolving our differences in this sector likely will be difficult and complicated by both real and imagined incidents of cyber espionage and piracy. Unlike the areas of dispute regarding trade and even regional security, there isn't much room here for give and take, for meeting in the middle. You either steal stuff or you don't. In the absence of informed and interested diplomatic engagement, which is the case today, and a multilateral effort to bring pressure to bear, there is zero likelihood, in my view, that any progress will be made in this sector. Perhaps the single most important objective for both sides in the U.S.-China relationship would be the elimination in the security relationship of uncertainty and surprise. A mutual no surprises policy might have short-circuited the Chinese interpretation of President Obama's pivot to Asia as a strategic decision to contain China and to restrain its growth. A mutual no surprises policy would have provided a line of communication for the Chinese to explain their rationale behind the militarization of the reefs in the South China Sea after insisting that they had no intention of doing so. And a mutual no surprises policy, coupled with U.S. re-engagement with Japan, Korea, and the nations of Southeast Asia, just might open avenues to the settlement of the resource disputes in the South China Sea. Plagued by ignorance, misunderstanding, and miscommunication, seized with panic and fear, U.S. and China easily could continue on a course toward a collision of values and interests, raising the risk of all-out war, a failing world economy, and an existential threat to the future of life on our planet. On both sides of the relationship today, ascendant nationalists assert that a web of global trading relationships can be blown away with little damage to the economy of either country. The politics of demonology have taken root in both China and the United States, building potentially insurmountable barriers to trust and cooperation. But remember this. There has never been another time in the history of the world, not once, in all of the 16 cases studied by Graham Allison and his colleagues in the Thucydides Project, there has never been another time when two powerful economies, two exceptional societies, were together so dominant in the world, together sharing more than half of the total world GDP, and at the same time so mutually interdependent. In his book on China, Kissinger described a conversation with Jiang Zemin, the former president of China. Jiang observed, and I'm quoting him, that the United States and China need each other because both were too large to be dominated, too special to be transformed, and too necessary to each other to afford isolation. If China and the United States both approach these trade, IP, and security challenges with clear and undisguised strategic purpose, with acuity, wisdom, and patience, and with accumulated confidence and trust, our two great nations could slip the noose, avoid the Thucydides trap, and manage a shared hegemony that could save the planet and benefit every realm of human endeavor. Cross your fingers. Thank you.
Anyone have a question?
Mr. Cutler, yes, sir. We learned a long time ago in law school, if you're a trial lawyer, never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. That's why we did thousands of depositions. How does the fact that China is one of our, if not our largest creditor, play into all this in the future? I'm also an Air Force judge advocate of 23 years. So I saw war during Vietnam, as you did when you were in Washington.
Well, let me, first of all, you're right that you never ask a question to which you don't know the answer, so I should ask you what the answer is. As far as the debt's concerned, they own our debt. Now, that has two effects, I think. The first is that we don't want them to sell that debt very quickly, because the impact on our economy will be dramatic and not good. And they haven't yet. The second effect is that because they own our debt, they have a very deep interest in the success of our economy and our ability to keep paying interest on that debt. It's a lot like a bank that has a mortgage on your house and doesn't want you to lose your job. But this debt, the relationship with respect to the debt, the relationship with respect to the extraordinary presence of U.S. companies in China, the import-export relationship. I mean, this is we're tied at the hip, and I'm taking too long with this question, but it's a good one. And so, it seems to me that how we talk to each other the language we use with each other is enormously important in trying to build a relationship of trust and confidence. And with respect to their holdings of our debt, nothing could be more important than trust and confidence.
Thank you. My name is Matt Ward, and I'm a retired Foreign Service officer who some time ago was Consul General in Shanghai and subsequently worked for the U.S. Trade Representative under the first Bush president. This was an excellent presentation of the way both sides see one another.
Thank you.
And way back when the primary Chinese official I was dealing with was a guy named Jiang Zemin, who was the mayor of Shanghai.
Right.
We went out of our way, particularly with military visits, to try to get a sense of understanding between the two military establishments. And one of the things I see is a growing fear on both sides. Chinese military, the Chinese Navy, don't trust us as much as we used to, and our Navy and our military don't trust the Chinese as much. And Thucydides was absolutely right. Fear is what causes wars. We have more fear on both sides. So my question is, what do we do to help eliminate that fear and start reestablishing, because at one point I think it did exist, a sense of trust where both sides can work with one another?
That's the central question. Thank you. I mean, what you don't do is you don't cancel the defense conversations. What you don't do is you don't cancel visits by military leaders and ships to the other to each other's ports. There is this notion, and it was, I thought, pretty implicit in the vice president's speech. There is this notion that you can't have trust and confidence and disagree with someone. That's just not the case. That's just not the case. I mean, Melanie and I disagree all the time. And I think we trust each other and have confidence in each other. You have to be able to achieve that basic level before you can communicate, and you have to communicate before you can solve disagreements and avoid problems and conflict and war. And I think that language is, words are important. The words that we use, and for that matter, the words that they use, and how they translate into each other's languages is terribly important. And I must say that I don't think there's much understanding about that on either side right now, and it's distressing. That's why I said cross your fingers.
Thank you all so much for being here tonight. Thank you to Mr. Cutler.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Elliot Cutler, lawyer and former candidate for Maine's governor. He recently addressed a town hall meeting with the World Affairs Council, explaining how the global influence of China could offset the dominance of the U.S. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Toe. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.